Hello, I'm Liz Wright. Welcome to Are You Looking at Me? And International Day for People with Disability. Today on the show, we meet Trish Maloney and Frank Horbentig, who are some of the elders in the activism scene. I hope you enjoy these really lengthy conversations. I really did. I really enjoyed them as well. Here's Frank.
Frank, when were you born?
Port Fairy.
You were born in Port Fairy?
I was born in Port Fairy.
And who did you live with?
Dad was actually a fireman, which is not a fire engine man, but a steam train.
Oh, okay.
Fireman, which is assistant train driver, and he stoked the fire. So he was living there. He met, got good friends with another guy named Harold Davis, who was a local teacher. And then two sisters came down from Melbourne to have a holiday.
Yeah.
And they stayed at the same boarding house, and it turned out that they married these two guys, me mum and
your auntie.
Alice. Yeah. Married me dad and Uncle Harold. And then mum and dad stayed there. And my sister Sue, my older sister, she was born there. I was born there, and Les was born there as well. Sue was, I think it's right, 1952. Me, 53, Les, 54, and then Annie, 56.
Wow, so yeah. They all had the kids pretty close together.
Yeah. Well, in those days, that's what you did, particularly a country town, nothing to do. First three kids, so me and Les, we all had some type of disability to do with muscle wastage.
And is it genetic or, familial in some way?
Yeah, that's what the doctors at the Royal Children said. But fourth sister, the last sister, Annie, didn't have it at all.
Oh.
So after rolling the dice and getting it three times, the fourth one didn't. Mum thought it might have been some sort of environmental factors, but, you know, the doctor was pretty insistent that he was the expert, so, he knew what was going on, and she was just silly thinking about other things. The funny thing about that was that Les and went with Mum to see this doctor at the Royal Children's, and of course he's a professor and he's expert in everything, and so he wasn't very sympathetic about Mum wanting to know maybe there was other things. Les and him had a raging row.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She stood up to him and really got stuck into him. Not because, you know, what he said may not be true, but they wanted to ask questions.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was God, and God, you never ask questions of God.
No.
You know, particularly when they're doctors.
So. No.
I mean, even today, although things have changed a lot, you know, you still get those sort of medicos that... You know, that know everything and don't like to be questioned.
With the four of you, you all lived at home.
Yeah.
And the three of you had disabilities. Did you go to mainstream school?
In the beginning, yeah. Annie was born, we'd actually, 55, we moved back to Melbourne to stay with my grandparents at the North Fitzroy Railway Station.
Oh, great.
That's why I like trains.
Yeah.
Steam trains and... Annie was born here in at the Royal Women's.
So, what was it like with
you? Because it was on the inner circle, and although it wasn't open to passengers anymore, they put the goods trains through there. So we often had goods trains, steam trains full of briquettes and wood, and as they did in those days.
How big was it? The house.
Well, what had happened was that when they didn't put passengers through there anymore, they made the houses, the railway stations, into houses for railway employees.
Yeah.
Probably three bedrooms and a lounge, kitchen. Yeah, so it seemed to be quite big. But it was just the old railway station. The North Carlton... railway station, probably, which is now community centre, is now the other only one existence.
That seems so romantic, I think, to live on the siding.
Yeah.
Don't you reckon? Like, particularly if you're into trains.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, and you're close to the city and... Oh, well, that sounds amazing.
Well, I was, what, four, so being close to the city didn't really matter.
Yeah.
Matter to me. It didn't mean anything, but certainly the railway, the trains coming through, you know, just over the fence where I could get up on the fence and look over and see the trains going through. So, yeah, that's great.
So did you go to North Fitzroy Primary?
No, we went to Brunswick Street Primary. But I only did half of prep there. And then in 59, we came out here. We went to Altona because my grandfather had to retire, and when he retired, they couldn't live there anymore, so they bought a house in Altona.
Wow.
And we all moved out there. So I did the final half of my year there, and then the next year I actually went down to Mount Eliza to the Royal Children's Hospital down there for about half a year. Or maybe 3 months.
To stay in the hospital?
Yeah. Yeah, the orthopaedic ward down there.
And what sort of things, what happened there?
Yeah, they did operations and physiotherapy and all that sort of stuff. Evaluated, investigated.
And how was that for a little kid?
Mum used to come and see us as often as she could. You had to say goodbye to your mum.
Yeah.
And then they sort of looked after you. I was, you know, quite young, so I mean, I can't remember being teary or anything, but I know I can remember getting out of the harness all the time.
And trying to nick off?
Just to get out of the harness. They'd have harness to tie you down so you couldn't get out of bed.
Oh, at night?
All day.
Oh, God.
So,
what was that supposed to do for
you? Just, you know, I don't know any stuff, but I was sort of young boy who liked to run all over the place. So, and then after that we went to Altona Primary till I was in year six.
Yeah.
And then again I had Les and I, we came back to Mount Eliza to have operations on our spine.
Yeah.
To put in some metal rods called Harrington Jacks.
Both of you at the same time?
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so, and that was to straighten our spines, keep them from curving anymore.
Yeah.
And then the next year we got out and I started high school, Altona High School.
Yeah.
And I was there for Form 1. The next year, Form 2, I did about half a year and then... the other half, I went back to
Mount Eliza
to get the rods out because they weren't working and have some operations on the ankles. When I got back, it's very difficult for me to manage high school anymore because unlike primary school, you didn't have a home classroom. Yeah. Like, you're moving around all over the place.
Yeah.
And it was just too much walking for me.
And exhausting.
Yeah, yeah. I was still walking without support, so
yeah.
So that was, Form 3, I started doing correspondence, but I wasn't really managing that much very well. So then I went to Eurella Carlton, and there were teachers there who could help me with correspondence. So.
What was that experience like, going to Eurella then?
Well, not a big deal, I suppose. The biggest deal was getting there.
Yeah.
Because we do, you know, like a taxi to the bus. Bus would do all over the western suburbs.
Yeah.
Pick people up and then take them into Carlton, into Pelham Street. So every morning and every night was quite a big trip, quite an adventure. So I did that till Form 4. And then in Form 5, they... decided that Carlton wasn't didn't have the teachers to teach us. Well, I went to Baldwin. But Les and Sue had been doing that pretty much since the beginning of their high school.
Yeah.
So they'd stayed there and boarded there over the weekend. When I joined them, we used to come home on the weekend. So that was good. That, and again, Friday afternoon and Sunday night, Sunday afternoon was two big trips, you know, to get back to Bourne.
Were there lots of kids boarding there at the time?
Yeah, yeah, probably 32 boys and about the same girls, separated, of course, by boys downstairs and girls upstairs. And then, of course, we just attend the Stroud Street Yarrala School, which, you know, again, pretty much operated like Yarrala Carlton.
Yeah.
You know, mostly primary kids and a few higher grades in Form 1, 2, 3 and 4.
You've mentioned Sue. Like, you and Leslie have had the profile as being activists and advocates.
Yeah,
Sue didn't go down that path with you and Leslie?
Well, Sue died in 75.
Oh, okay, so a long time ago.
And I can
tell
you now that Sue was the righteous one.
Oh, okay.
She was... Everything was black and white.
Yeah.
It was either right or it was wrong.
Yeah.
So, in her... so, when she finished school, she was confined to a wheelchair and she only had the use of one arm. So she did typing at Yarrala Inability House, South Melbourne. And she had a few conflicts there with management. So they had a group of girls with disabilities who were doing the typing, but it was all right for them to get work that they'd got in. But when one day when they were doing Yarrala work, the manager in charge came out and snatched it all off them, you know, because they were untrustworthy.
Oh, wow. That's big.
Yeah. But, you know, in those days that was the sort of attitude, you know, that, Yarrala management had, you know. It's they were there to look after people, not to... empower people or to see people as equals. You know, in the early days of our activism, you know, the chief organisations that we fought against were the, you know, ACROD, or, which is now National Disability Services, because the, you know, the old ACROD was made up of organisations that run the lives of, you know, people with disabilities, including, you know, the RVIB. And... so it was, you know, well-meaning people from the high society who were looking after the cripples.
Yeah.
Because that was the good thing to do. I remember one day there was a fete out at Yarrala Bourne, and Barry Humphreys came along. And so we're all down on the quadrangle and he's standing up on a walkway with the charity women and the president or whatever.
Yeah.
And he cracks his joke and he says, I'm very glad to be here today with the matrons of Yarrala, who have one house in Toorak and the other in Portsea.
You're listening to Are You Looking At Me on International Day of People with Disability, and this is Frank Hall Bentick.
Well, I didn't move out my family home until 87. Yeah, mainly because I wasn't independent. I needed some assistance with showering and get me boots, some shoes on, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
By then I had a job, so I was working, and I bought a place here and moved in here. When I started at the Public Service Board in 75, our union was controlled by the DLP. And they were quite conservative towards union issues. And at the same time, there was a reform group that started to reform the union and sort of push it more to the left. And I became active in that. I was local delegate for Public Service Board for a while. Got a bit active in as lead up to IYDP, the union's disability committee. Les had started as one of the project officers with the DRC in early 81, and she said to me, look, why don't you come over and just help us? And went over and folded envelopes and, well, licked envelopes and folded papers to put in envelopes and all that stuff that you know you do to And then late 81, I joined the board. And then in 84, I left Public Service Board and went to work there as a coordinator for the Disability Resources Centre.
I can't imagine going to DRC from Public Service was a hike.
Well, it was, actually.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm really surprised by that.
I had sort of hit a bit of a glass ceiling in the Public Service. Got one promotion, but I suppose sometimes you get a bit... People know you, but and they make assumptions about what you can do.
Go back to 1981. So that was the year of people with disability and the first time that happened.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Was that like an American thing?
No. It was a UN.
A UN?
United Nations.
Okay, yeah.
So around the world at that time, there was a growing movement of people with disabilities representing themselves. The UN got a lot of pressure into doing something. So they made it more a PR exercise than an actual change society, human rights issues. So,
how did Australia respond?
Pretty much the same way. They had a big international year. Local councils had set up committees, every man his dog had a friend who was disabled. But most of us realised that, it was just PR hype.
Yeah.
And that if anything was going to change, then we needed to be at the vanguard of making that change ourselves. All these well-meaning people in ACROD and, who was saying how wonderful things were and weren't going to change the status quo. Mm. They were happy with the status quo. And, politicians the same. So we decided that we had to do stuff. And all that was at the same time as a growing world movement around that as well, through Disabled Peoples International. They actually had the first World Congress of DPI in Singapore in December 1981. And quite a number of Australians went there, people with disabilities. And they came back with the mandate energy to develop a national organisation, a multi-diagnostic organisation in Australia. So they came back. In 82, we set up a Disabled Peoples International in all the various states.
Mm.
And then in 1983, here in Melbourne, we had our first National Assembly. We elected a board or council to represent people from all over that. So I worked at the DRC for 9 years, and then I thought it was time to change. So then I worked as a disability officer at Centrelink. 86, when the new Disability Act talked about phasing out shelter workshops, Wesley Central Mission made the decision, yes, we will do this. They closed it down and found as many places for people as they could. Not all of them got jobs. And then they started up Westworks, which is a supported employment service, which in those days meant that, they looked for open employment jobs. And if you needed someone to be with you for a week or a month while you learned the job, then they could help you with that.
With the development of the first Disability Discrimination Act.
Yep.
Who was doing the work on that, and were you involved?
There'd previously been state anti-discrimination acts, and not in one. I'd been to a conference overseas, and I'd got a copy of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And when I came back, Steve and I went and saw a local member who was Deputy PM, Prime Minister in those days. Anyway, it was Steve, Gianni and I. Steve went with some issues around the ACL had around advocacy stuff, and I went to see if we could get a National Discrimination Act. So I gave him the document, as you do with the politicians, and next thing we know, he's actually did something about it.
So thank you, Frank.
don't even think I'll be recognised, but, when it originally came out, there was a few exemptions, Immigration was one. The telecommunications was another one, although that had a use-by date, you know, that would only last for a while. It meant that you couldn't make a claim against an accessible phone system.
Oh, OK. Besides the exemptions, were people using the Act or...?
Well, the Act is as it is now.
Mm.
Yeah, look, people made complaints, but if they didn't compromise in their conciliation, most found it very difficult to go to the federal court. I mean, when you get statistics from you know, the Australian Human Rights Commission around that, I mean, they give you conciliated outcomes as a good result.
Yeah.
And most people have usually compromised around their conciliated outcome. They haven't got originally what they asked for. Now, that may have been unrealistic, but quite often they were encouraged to take a lesser...
Yeah.
A lesser outcome, you know, to get at least something. I've never used it. I've usually used State Equal Opportunity Act.
What have you complained about?
Quite a number of complaints around taxis.
Yeah.
I complained against the Boyd Cinemas in Bourke Street and the Greater Union in Russell Street because they were both inaccessible, didn't have accessible toilets. The Hoyts one in Bourke Street did. There were three steps down to the mezzanine floor where the accessible toilet was.
Yeah.
The Hoyts one was conciliated, put in what I requested. The Greater Union wasn't conciliated. We went to VCAT. Well, I researched everything, you know. I represented myself. My mum was my assistant. And they had a QC, a barrister.
Yeah.
And two solicitors on the other side. I'd asked for them to have one of these step lifts. Because at the Grading Union, they had a basement where there was a theatre in the basement, two on the mezzanine floor, and then the rest, three upstairs.
Yeah.
And they're all led by steps. They had no disability toilets, though. So I put my complaint in. They didn't want to do anything about it. So we went to VCAT. And, so they then commenced to do stuff about it. And they put in a toilet on the ground floor, put a ramp down to the two theatres at the mezzanine floor.
Yeah.
But they didn't do anything about the basement or the upper ones. So we start the hearing. They've said that they've done all this wonderful work. We go down to see it. We go down to Russell Street. And Russell Street, because it was on a hill, it had one step to get up to into the foyer. And at one end of the building, at the Bourke Street end, it was quite a high step.
Yeah.
But further up at the other end of the building, it was a lip about 2 inches.
Yeah.
So we get there and I can see that they just put concrete down. Oh, how wonderful, isn't this? And I look over and I see the guys in the truck because we'd come, so they'd just finished. I looked at them and thought, that's wet. I said to the manager of the Great Union Theatre, I said, oh, I don't think I better go up that. I said, that's not dry yet. He said, oh, no, that's fine. I went up it, but I didn't go up it. I just ploughed into it. There's great big furrows into this concrete. And I backed out. And here the, you know, there's these big wheel marks, you know, like tracks in the road, you know. And, oh, gee, isn't that a shame? So the guys piled out. They helped me up. Anyway, the whole upshot of all that was that the commissioner... He'd come up with his own brilliant idea that would be cost-free. And he said that if they rotated the films, then I could see the, you know, the good films because
they'd be two on there
that
cinema.
You had the access to were smaller theatres with that didn't have the blockbusters in it because of the size. But he said that they would rotate them. So they agreed to rotate them and, you know, I'd often go in there, but you know, I seem to be, always catch the day when the particular ones I wanted to see went rotating through those
right
bottom two. So it was a compromise that that you know didn't really give me any more access than I had. So
yeah.
Anyway,
you and Leslie did a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
Did you, as siblings, say, all right, let's do this, or just because of the nature of what you were both doing, you'd end up working together or being on committees and boards together?
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of the active protesting together as well?
Yeah. We did. In the early days of DRC, back in the early 80s, the Women with Disabilities Feminist Collective,
yeah,
which Les had set up with a number of other feminist disabled women, was working at a DRC. And so they would meet there, particularly of an evening, to have their campaigns, particularly when the anti-Miss Victoria stuff was coming up.
Yeah.
So quite often we would join them for the annual event for a number of years. They had it at the Heidelberg Town Hall.
Yeah.
And we would go and be there and demo out the front and, you know, make noise and, you know, call out to all the well-dressed people when they're going in to stop oppressing disabled people. And at that stage, the people from Penny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Murray and Martin and that mob.
Steve Hurd. They were working with us, but mainly through transport stuff.
Yeah.
And so they also come along to those demos. The issue was an issue that oppressed all people with disabilities in that, you know, that sort of image of that, you know, that the quest portrayed was, you know, these poor cripples need to be, we need to raise funds for them and look after them.
Yeah.
But predominantly, the blokes stood back and we were in a more supportive role.
Yeah.
Thank you.
and welcome to Are You Looking at Me? This is the International Day of Disability broadcast, and today we're speaking with Frank Horbentic and Trish Maloney. Trish is one of the survivors of polio, and I started off by asking her about polio.
I got polio at the age of 4 months, and I have residual paralysis on my left side, so my left leg is completely paralysed, so I use calipers and crutches to get around. How did I get into this work? Well, it was by accident. I was working for Victoria Police as a research officer, and one of the senior officers came up to me and said, would you be the force's internal disability liaison officer? And I said, I have no idea what that means or anything to do with disabilities. I don't know anything about it. And she said, but you've got one. And I went, oh, I hadn't thought of it like that, because I'd just been living my life.
So you just managed. You didn't actually think, oh, you know, I'm a person with disability. You just managed.
No, I didn't. And considering that I'm one of 10 children, I think Mum was a bit pushier with me than she was with anybody else. So I went to live in an Aboriginal community when I was 20, and I think that started my social justice career. Nobody else in my family was talked into doing something like that. It was my, like, be independent, go and live a life. Don't sit at home waiting for something to happen.
How did you end up living in an Aboriginal community?
There was an ad in the paper. Mum said, why don't you apply for that? And I said, that sounds like a good idea. I did, and next thing you knew, I was there.
What was your job?
A radio operator. So I was there for Cyclone Tracy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
That's great.
It was amazing. It was amazing experience. I only lasted a year. It was a two-year contract, but I only lasted a year because I kept arguing with management about their treatment of Aboriginal people. They weren't seen as human.
So, no. It's so that's the 70s, isn't it?
19. It was 74.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because I had grown up with nuns and priests and they were all good guys. And all of a sudden I found these people who I didn't think were good guys. So it opened my eyes a fair bit. So anyway, so I did that. So I was working for police. They said, will you be the disability liaison officer? And I went, okay. And I started to actually then explore disability. And that was in the 90s. I had done.
Who was around you then? Like, who did you meet at that time? Like, because when you come into a sector that you didn't know existed... I'm just going to shut this door because it's raining so hard now.
Yeah,
but
no
keep
problem.
Talking.
So it really, I didn't meet anybody back then. So it was only for those internal who had been injured. So internal officers who'd been injured. And I was doing an anthropology degree. So I actually did my qualitative research around people with disabilities who had returned to work in Victoria Police.
Wow.
So I did that for a couple of years, and then I went on to work in firearms because I knew nothing about that. And then I went to work in IT because I knew nothing about that. And then I retired because I got post-polio syndrome and my body stopped working. I couldn't read for 2 years.
Tell me, what's post-polio syndrome?
So post-polio syndrome, I had polio.
Yeah.
And then because I overworked my muscles, the nerve endings started to die.
Oh.
And so I got increased paralysis, increased pain. Went back into calipers and crutches. My arms are going, my voice is going. My voice is going, what am I going to do?
What are you going to do?
I know, it's yeah. awful.
Learn something else.
I know.
Auslan.
Oh, well, I keep talking, looking at assistive technology, you know, so I'll get a communication tool. But anyway, so these are the things that happen when you have polio. You get post-polio syndrome. And so I decided to be a stand-up comedian instead.
Really?
I did Geez Louise.
Did you?
I did. And so I was big on the disability circuit, let me tell you. So I did that and I loved it. But then I went and did a gig at the then Victorian Women with Disabilities Feminist Collective. And I went, I've come home. This is where I need to be. This is where I fit. It was like I'd found my people.
So this was Leslie Hall and a few other people.
Leslie Hall,
it?
Karen Howe,
yeah.
Carlene Plunkett.
Yeah.
Who else was there back then? Oh, my goodness. Natalie Thomas.
Yep.
So many women that were, you know, some of them are gone now. But it was, you know, I just went, oh, actually, I can do this. So Carlene Plunkett was the convener back then.
Yeah.
And she was about to stand down. And so they asked, would I take it over? So, you know, go and do a comedy gig and end up taking it over. And it was really interesting because I had no idea what I was getting into. I had no idea of disadvantage because I've always been a white working class woman who's always been in paid employment, has always been in mainstream schooling, mainstream employment. I had no idea the level of disadvantage that others were facing. And so I thought, okay, this is something I can do. So Carlene was my first mentor. So Carlene had or has cerebral palsy and she's still a good mate of mine.
Yeah.
Just she's moved to Donald. I went up and saw her just recently, which was great. So we started to talk about what are the issues. And so I had no idea about family violence. I had no idea about sexual assault because that wasn't part of my life. And so Carlene took me by the hand and told me who I should be talking to. And one of those people was Marilyn Beaumont, who was the executive officer of Women's Health Victoria. So we went into partnership. We were given some money and we didn't have the capacity to hold that money ourselves. We didn't have a DRG status or anything
like
that.
So you wanted like some sort of auspice to assist you, yeah.
So Marilyn and I went into partnership together. The two organisations,
yeah,
and we worked to develop an advocacy information service. And it was a lot of trial and error because what we wanted to talk about was access to mainstream services, not access to disability services. We wanted to enlighten the mainstream. So we employed a few people, trialled them, but they weren't the right fit. So in the end, what we did was we went to the women's hospital and negotiated to employ Karen Howe.
So what was she doing then? What was
she
doing
was the manager of women's social services at the women. So we thought, so we got a year's secondment. They gave her a year off to come and work for us and we found the money to pay her what she was worth, which was great. And then we thought, well, what we need to do is corporatise Women with Disabilities Victoria so we could hold the money ourselves and we could grow the organisation. So while we were doing that, I was also sitting on the Statewide Steering Committee to Reduce Sexual Assault and the Statewide Steering Committee to Reduce Family Violence. And this was at the time of the development of the Disability Act, the development of the new family violence protection laws. And so we got written in that paid and unpaid carers could be perpetrators for the purposes of the Act, which is still revolutionary.
What time are we talking about?
This is about 2006. So wow. I left Victoria Police in 2000 and I got involved with Women with Disabilities Victoria in about 2003. So after we developed the new organisation, Karen became the executive officer.
Yep.
And we could have worked it differently. I really didn't want to go into full-time employment. My health wasn't good enough back then. And I became the inaugural chair of the board. So we still worked together.
Mm.
It was quite a period of adjustment. There was a lot of stuff going on then. So we wrote the position paper on abortion, access to abortion for women with disabilities at the time of the decriminalisation of abortion. So I was also on that working party as well. Because what we wanted to do was make sure that it was my body, my choice. It's always been my maxim. I don't care whether you believe in it or you don't believe in it, but don't impose anything on me. It's my body. It's my choice what I do.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, sort of it was a quite difficult time because we had people with acquired disabilities who were saying, or perhaps we ought to abort abnormal fetuses.
I'm Liz Wright, this is Are You Looking At Me, and you're listening to Trish Maloney.
And I ask this question of people often. There is a hierarchy in disability.
There is absolutely a hierarchy.
So kind of, I guess it was a rhetoric question. And it annoys me so much because I don't like terms like high and low functioning and all that sort of stuff. I understand complex needs and things like that. But there is a hierarchy. And those who often come to disability late think that they're better off.
They think they're better.
Yes.
And I think society thinks that people who come to disability later are more deserving than those of us who have always had a disability. And I'll give you an example which isn't about disability, but I had a woman say to me recently when I'm developing some training around financial abuse. And I saw that this thing was advertised about financial abuse, so I thought I'd go along and hear what she's got to say. And she couldn't look at me. She really couldn't look at me. It was like she was embarrassed because I was in the room. And then she said, the women I deal with earn $300,000 a year. The poor have always been poor, so they're used to it. And I just went, I'm in the wrong place. But it really is about that with disability too. So you've got the example of the Invictus Games, where if you're a soldier, you're more deserving of support from the community because you've been a soldier, or if you've had an accident, or if you've been a footballer and you have an accident. Whereas those of us who have long-term or congenital disabilities have suffered the exclusion for all of our lives. And yet, you know, the people who are being praised because they're running or they're jumping or they're kicking a ball, it's like, look at you, you've overcome that. And they're the ones that have been looking down on us all their lives, and that's why they're suffering the mental anguish, if you like. Of acquiring disability. Now, I don't resent any of them for getting the support they need. What I have a problem with is the mainstream dialogue about it.
Scratch the surface and then see what the dialogue is. And dialogue is not very flattering to mainstream society generally about their opinions of disability, but also our government's policies around that.
Absolutely. The other thing that drives me crazy about the disability sector, and I will reference Stella Young and inspiration porn, people send me photos of people without legs climbing mountains. I don't care. I'm not going to climb a mountain. It's no point sending it to me. I usually send back a photo of somebody with legs climbing a mountain. So yeah. I'm glad you sent that to me. Here's a photo of somebody who's an able-bod who's climbing a mountain. So why don't you go and do it?
Yeah.
It's just a ridiculous notion that we've got.
On inspiration porn, I have to say, I do have an opinion on that. I think I understand what Stella was talking about. Like, why are we praising people for living their lives?
Absolutely.
And it's really muddied the waters, because when people do something that's super great...
Absolutely.
Now there's a self-consciousness about... complimenting. And I think there are people who do great stuff, and it doesn't need to reference their disability. It should reference their greatness.
Absolutely. And I agree with you completely, and it's because people have only heard inspiration porn and they don't understand that it's not about saying, look, you've inspired me because you've overcome great adversity to climb a mountain. That's fine. But I'll give you an example. I went for lunch in Bendigo with my friend Carlene from Donald.
Now,
Carlene has cerebral palsy. She had to travel down by bus. And my friend Jodie Barney from Shepparton, who's deaf, and she travelled down by car. And I travelled up from Melbourne. So we met there for lunch. And it took us 3 years because three of us are all so busy. So we get there and that's fine. And the woman who was serving us kept coming over and saying, are you right? Do you need anything, sweetheart?
How are you going, doll?
Yeah, that sort of thing. And that's fine. And then when we left and we paid the bill, she said, you three are so inspirational. And I just looked at her and I said, for having lunch. And she looked at me oddly. And I think that's what the core of what Stella was trying to get at.
That's
was
right.
That whole, don't tell me I'm inspirational because I'm doing what you all do.
I'm having a wine. I'm eating food, you know.
I travel overseas as often as I can, and I travel with a friend, mainly because Noel always says I really don't want to travel, so that's fine. And Leonie's great. But she gets so cross with people who come up and treat me differently to the way they treat her. So we were in a rainstorm, standing next to a volcano or a waterfall or something.
And all woman, the same when you're travelling, isn't it?
From one thing
natural,
to the next,
natural wonders.
Can I tell you that Leonie and I were the only two who got off the bus to climb the volcano and everybody else didn't because it was raining.
Right?
So anyway, so we're there and this woman gets off the bus and she comes and she pulls a raincoat over my head.
Without asking
you? Yeah, just, and she said, oh, I'm so worried about you getting wet. And Leonie went, I'm here. She said, I only had one raincoat. And I don't use raincoats. I'm quite happy to get wet and dry.
Yeah.
But it's the, oh, my God, you're so fantastic. You're actually out. Yeah, I'm having a holiday. I'm not doing anything spectacular. But it annoys Leonie more often than it annoys me because I'm so used to it, I don't even hear it anymore.
Well, my sister, there's six kids in my family, but only two of us that have low vision. And my sister, at the end of her pregnancy, was told not to walk too much and stuff. So her and her partner went to IKEA and she had to use a wheelchair. And she said it wasn't the same insight into, oh, I don't understand what it is to see, although she's really great about it. She does have insight and she's fantastic. But she said she just couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, Richard, who's not the shopper, was getting all this attention and no one spoke to her.
I know. It's really annoying.
No one spoke to her.
Every so often I use a wheelchair from time to time.
Yeah.
And there really is a different attitude. And another thing is that you're treated differently if you have a temporary disability to if you have a permanent one.
Absolutely.
So I'm on crutches all the time and people come up to me all the time and say, I was on crutches once. No, they say, I was on crutches once. It's really hard. And I always say, well, actually, I don't find it difficult at all. I find it absolutely invigorating. I can actually walk if I use my crutches. And they go, oh. And I say, yeah, this is as good as it gets. I'm really happy with my life. I'm on crutches and I'm able to do things. And they go, so what happened? And I say, I had polio from the age of 4 months. And their attitude towards me changes. So they're quite happy to say, you know, you're a normal person.
Broke my ankle once.
You're a normal person who's just got a temporary disability.
Yeah.
But when you've got a permanent disability, they can't reference it.
Yeah. I know.
It's really interesting that as an anthropologist by training, this to me is really interesting stuff around how do I get treated. And is it different for the younger ones coming up? Do they acknowledge some of this too?
I'm pretty sure younger ones are thinking about it. But I don't know. I feel like a lot of communication is done vicariously through, you know, devices. So often people have had an introduction to themselves through the internet, through Facebook, through Instagram. But when I was like a young woman, it was just you would be at a party and someone would notice that you couldn't make great eye contact or something. And so then you were talking about it in the party. Whereas for now, a lot of young people, I think people know, oh, so-and-so uses a wheelchair or so-and-so has a guide dog before they actually arrive at the event.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if that's
a difference,
an equalising thing to a certain extent, or not equalising, but maybe a
we don't entree. Have to talk about it, or it's not it's not you don't have to see the shock on somebody's face when you turn up.
Yeah,
and maybe that is part of it.
Why would a vision impaired person want to come to outdoor cinema or moonlight cinema at the Botanical Gardens? Like, why would they want to be there?
But it's even things like event planning. You know, sort of my sister had a 50th birthday party and it was at an event where the lift broke down.
Oh.
And it was up on the first floor. She was horrified and I managed to get up there because I thought it's not her fault.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between what I do because somebody's with the best of intentions made an error.
Yes.
And what I'll do when somebody's deliberately excluded me because...
Yeah. Well, we've all got that. I'm exactly the same. Yeah. I feel very strongly about that. I'll make an effort and I can be quite forgiving when someone's made an effort and it's not their fault.
That's right. I really admire the women and the men who came before me, like the Frank Hall Bentics and the Leslie Halls and the Karen Howes and the Charlie Plunkett and the Jody Saxton Barneys and those ones. And you sort of think, sometimes I feel I'm being left behind.
Yeah.
You know, like I just don't think that people understand that the struggles that we had to actually bang on the doors and say, let us in.
Well, that's exactly what I think too. I think exactly that, Tricia, because I think sometimes people don't know what they don't know.
Absolutely.
And even when they're reading forward, they're not reading back. And we all come from a history of people doing stuff in advance of our arriving here. And I'm in admiration of that. I just cannot imagine like Leslie going to that beauty pageant where she was there being patronised and then ousted. And then when you see film footage where it was like, how repulsive for these people with disability to be there.
And considering that this was a money to raise money for those poor people with disabilities.
Yes, I know.
And she threw herself on the stage, and I just think, do the younger ones know that this happened?
Yeah.
That there was that activism. And Katie Ball,
yes,
who used to chain herself to the front of trams. I mean, yeah, that's not my style. I'm quite happy to do it verbally. And,
yes.
And, yeah, and I call myself the nag to government, you know. Yeah. Sort of, I go and nag government. Yeah. And yeah, I have ministers say, we haven't heard from you for a while.
What's wrong?
Say, yeah, well, it's because you've been doing the right thing. So I'm quite happy to do that. And I think we need the variety of different
approaches, yeah, and advocacy styles.
But I think that my style is often disregarded because there's no open publicity about it.
Yes, and I think there's a lot of very strong self-promoters, and if it's not your style to be a self-promoter, and it's great,
wonderful.
I think it's fantastic, but if it's not your style, then people don't know what goes on in that, like, slog, step by step, step way, chipping away at stuff, because activism is great, but it has to be followed up with actions.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of stuff that it's like a duck. Like, you see the stuff that's floating on the surface, yeah, but underneath there's, yeah, a whole lot of paddling, yeah, that goes on just to keep the momentum going.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember going to things years ago and saying, like in the family violence sector, how are you factoring women with disabilities into your programs, into your policies, and into your procedures?
Yeah.
And I knew I was starting to have an impact when other women were starting to say, how are you factoring women with disabilities, yeah, in? Because it's not about me, it's about the work, it's about how I can change it.
It's about what you're doing.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's also about how we can change it to make it easier for the next generation.
I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Frank Hall-Bentick and Trish Maloney today. I'd like to thank 3CR, the Disability Day team, and Annie McLaughlin for editing and production.
I wanted to be a cowboy and learn to crack a whip, stand up in that lonely street to six guns on my hip. Along the mighty Beatles came, and everyone went, ah! They could play and sing and everything, and of course that John could draw. Well, that was it for me. I never once looked back. Tricks to learn and waves to catch. I had a plan of attack. Are you looking at me? Are you looking at me? Are you looking at me? Are you looking at me, pal? Headed south, where the surf came crashing in, from black and white to colour, from innocence to sin. It was summer in December, blowing heat waves in my mind, people talking funny, some cruel and some were kind. From the crackle of the cane to the frown of a big black snake, from the breakers at Bondi and down to Wallaga Lake. From the sound of a million fly screen doors closing on the past, like that chimney the fires couldn't burn, I was built to last.
Are you looking at me?
Are you looking at me?
Are you looking at me?
Are you looking at me, pal? When I flew across the ocean, I was number one. People gave me everything, and I didn't need a gun. Walking down that avenue, I never felt so alive. People calling out my name, and I'd only just arrived. There was a tightrope walking bagpiper in the middle of Central Park. Steam was rising from the ground. I wore my cape out after dark. I had myself a moment, my day out in the sun. It's an unfinished story, but it's more than just begun. And I know more than one thing, but not more than two or three. And I'll tell you if you'll listen. and I'll tell you for free. It's no life being a cowboy and eating all them beans. Coffee's cold and the herd is gone, and all you've got's your dreams. You can always put your spurs back on, but save them for Halloween. You're better off heading north or somewhere you've never been.